You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, the crisis in Ukraine continues to deepen.
The Congress of the Delegates from the administrative districts of the Donetsk region, basing itself on the articles of the UN Charter and other international regulations that stipulate the right of peoples for self-determination, proclaims a sovereign state, Donetsk People's Republic.
Matthew Jameson and Raffaele Pantucci will tell us whether claims that the country is on the brink of civil war ring true. We'll hear whether closer military relations between the US and China could be on the cards, and we'll explain why the head of Hezbollah believes the war in Syria has been won for Assad. Also ahead in the programme...
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff. We'll discover why the CEO of Virgin Galactic wants to create a network of high-speed routes in space to cut down the time of long-haul travel here on Earth. All that, plus our woman in Rio will tell us why her city has lost out to Sao Paulo in the race for the most tourists, and we'll also give you an inside look at some of the top trends making waves at this year's Salone del Mobile. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. Before we begin, let's get the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Ukrainian police have cleared pro-Moscow protesters from a regional administration building in one city in eastern Ukraine, but two others held out today in what Kiev says is a Russian-led plan to dismember the country. Officers ended the occupation of the city of Kharkiv during an 18-minute so-called anti-terrorism action, but in Donetsk and Luhansk, Russian-speaking activists armed with Kalashnikov rifles and protected by barbed wire barricades vowed there was no going back on their demand, a vote on returning to Moscow. Rule. This has prompted concerns in Kiev that there could be Moscow-backed moves to break away, like in Crimea. Jen Psaki from the United States State Department has warned Russia not to support such moves.
He made clear that any further Russian efforts to destabilize Ukraine will incur further costs for Russia, and the ministers also discussed convening direct talks within the next 10 days between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the EU to try to de-escalate the tensions. Discussion about the right timing and agenda for that meeting will, of course, continue.
Former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden has just given testimony today to a parliamentary hearing on mass surveillance at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg. The U.S. intelligence operative, who spoke from Moscow via live video link for more than half an hour, said that the NSA had deliberately snooped on public bodies, that information was secretly collected on a vast scale and was not open to approval by public bodies. He said the programs used sophisticated techniques to track trillions of private communications. The United Nations has responded to important developments in Afghanistan and Somalia, lauding the success of last weekend's Afghanistan presidential and provincial elections, while strongly condemning the killing of two of its foreign workers in Somalia. Farhan Haq, the deputy spokesman for the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon, referred to a statement released by Moon in which he praised the higher-than-expected voter turnout in Afghanistan.
He said that the elections mark an important step forward in Afghanistan's first democratic transition of power. The millions of women and men who cast their ballots are a testament to the courage and the commitment of Afghans to exercise their right and shape their future. The Secretary General welcomes their momentous achievement. Afghans braved threats and intimidation to exercise their right to vote, and in doing so, they've sent a powerful message that the perpetrators of violence cannot win.
The leader of Turkey's main opposition party, Cemal Kılıçdaroğlu, was attacked at the Turkish parliament on Tuesday as he was heading to his party's weekly group meeting to deliver his speech. The incident was caught on by camera crews at the parliament buildings in the capital, Ankara. The assailant punched him in the face as the Republican People's Party leader was walking into a hallway outside the main chamber. The man was immediately overpowered by bodyguards. And finally here, a $20 million Fabergé Imperial Easter egg, lost from the public eye for decades before it was saved from the melting pot by a US scrap metal dealer, is to go on show for the first time in London for more than 100 years. Last seen displayed at a 1902 exhibition in St. Petersburg, the 3.5-inch golden egg, commissioned by the Russian Emperor Alexander III as a gift for his wife for Easter in 1887, was seized by the Bolsheviks during the chaos of the 1917 Russian Revolution and disappeared for years in the United States. Well, Kieran McCarthy is director of the Wartsky Antique Dealership.
It literally walked in through our front door. I was sat at my desk here, and in walked a gentleman, very, very modestly attired, and incredibly nervous also. And he walked up to the desk, never said why he was here, but he handed me a sheaf of photographs. And in these photographs were pictures of the third Imperial Easter egg, the missing Fabergé treasure.
And that, for the moment, is the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. As hearing there that Fabergé egg literally walked into the auction house.
I knew you'd pick up on those words, but you know what he meant.
Was it like Humpty Dumpty? Like an egg with little legs?
Kind of. I think he cracked open.
Oh, dear. Cracking some pretty bad gags. That's Jonathan Wheatley. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour with more. I'll make sure all of Jonathan's jokes are removed from his script. You're listening at the moment to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.07, 13.07 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Matthew Jameson, a consultant fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Raffaella Pantucci, an Asian specialist at RUSI also. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you both. Impeccably attired, I should say. I was joking, of course. I'm not wearing a necktie. I stand out like a sore thumb. It's terrible.
No, no.
Our top story today, we were hearing on the news from Jonathan a moment or two ago, the continuing crisis in Ukraine. In the moment, I'll get both of your thoughts on the situation. Before we do so, though, let's hear from Monocle's own Phil Hahn, bringing us all up to speed with this report.
The crisis in Ukraine continues. Police in the east of the country conducted what they called an anti-terror operation, retaking a regional government headquarters and arresting 70 separatists. A day earlier, separatists stormed the regional parliament in Donetsk, declaring it a people's republic.
The Congress of the Delegates from the administrative districts of the Donetsk region, basing itself on the articles of the UN Charter and other international regulations that stipulate the right of peoples for self-determination, proclaims a sovereign state, Donetsk People's Republic.
They're asking for a referendum to be held by May the 11th. The government in Kiev pointing the finger solely at the Kremlin. Ukraine's Prime Minister Oleksandr Turchynov.
Dear citizens of Ukraine, yesterday the second wave of the Russian Federation's special operation against Ukraine started. The goal is to destabilize the situation in the country, topple Ukrainian authorities, disrupt the elections, and tear our country apart.
The White House said there were outside forces involved in the protests and went to warn Russia of further costs. Analysts say it's all part of a smart, calculated move by Putin.
These people want to be liberated. They don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. But what I really think the bigger game is here, it's all a negotiation. If Russia gets what they want out of Kiev, they may not go into Ukraine or eastern Ukraine or try to take eastern Ukraine into Russia. So what these elections coming up, this really part of this is all part of a negotiating. Crimea and eastern Ukraine is a negotiating chip.
For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
Phil Hahn's report there. Raffaello and Matthew, as I said, with me. Raffaello, I'll start with you. Phil mentioned there a calculated move by Putin. Is that how you see this?
I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to know exactly what's happening here. I mean, I think it's clear that we're seeing problems on both sides. I think on the one hand, the Russians are taking advantage of the situation. I think Putin sees an opportunity, an opening. And, you know, he's proved repeatedly in the past that when you see an opening, you push and you push as hard as you can. So I'm sure that there's an element of that going on. I think the other side of this equation is the Ukrainian government, who I think are clearly not handling this maybe in the way that they should. I'm not sure. I mean, it's clear that these separatists or these individuals who have sort of taken over parts of these cities are a problem and need to be addressed. But whether we start calling them terrorists and referring it as an anti-terrorist operation is necessarily really going to help the situation. When at the end of the day, if what their aim is to retain the country's coherence as an entity and as a complete state, well, then you're going to have to accommodate and work with these people at some point. So I think that we're seeing sort of both sides are slightly miscalculated. I think the Russian side is maybe a little more calculating in a sort of pushing direction. I think the Ukrainian side Kiev needs to find a way of accommodating and working with these people at the same time.
Interesting, isn't it, Matthew, that Kiev has been seemingly very sort of restrained about this. Why do you think that is? Is there a problem, as Raffaello identifies there, with what their coherent strategy should actually be? How do we explain their sort of reticence to be more clear about their position?
I think, yeah, I mean, the Ukrainians have been terribly restrained, given the fact that they have had part of their territory invaded and annexed and violated, and then they're having these sort of these incursions from pro-Russian militia. The reason that they have been so restrained is because the basic hard raw military facts, which is they have a huge looming aggressor on their border, far, far more powerful militarily. They themselves haven't got a chance if it comes to a head-to-head blow. And also, for me, I think that the key moment here to watch is really the build-up to the May elections. I personally believe that what we're seeing now is the second stage, the second phase of what's been going on in Ukraine. First, they took advantage of the internal chaos, and there's a lot of chaos, of course, in the country because it's in this post sort of revolutionary ferment, and they took advantage of that to take Crimea. The next step is, as we're seeing now in Donetsk, I think this is part of a calculated rollout. We'll see more of these kinds of activities, pro-Russians stirring up problems, taking over buildings, declaring, separatism. We'll see a lot of that in the run-up to the election. Of course, elections create even more tensions and bring things to the surface. I feel as though Moscow is going to use this election to twist and turn and try to create as many divisions in Ukraine as possible. For the key point would be after the election in May. That is when I think they would then pounce on the east of the country. Because it's quite clear. I mean, they have built up a huge force on the border of Ukraine. Why are they doing that?
Well, maybe talk a little more about what Putin really wants in a moment. But just on that point about post-elections, the shifting sands, it seems to be one of those situations where it looks like the country is heading towards a much more serious conflict even than we've seen so far, a civil war. I mean, in fact, people have already used that word in some circles. Raffaello, what do you think? Is it unavoidable? One hesitates to sort of invite that sort of language even, but is that where this appears to be heading in your view?
I mean, it certainly seems to be heading in a sort of armed clash direction, you know, I mean, in an armed internal clash in the civil war with clearly one side that's being supported from the outside. I mean, you know, part of the problem, I think, what's happening here is that I'm not sure that the Kiev government has really gotten the sort of signals and sense of strength bolstering that they would expect or would want from some Western powers. I think they may be feeling that, you know, we're kind of in a bit of a pickle here and the West is not necessarily going to come leaping to our aid. I'm sure people's minds are drawn immediately back to Georgia. You know, and what we saw in Georgia was, frankly, the West got very excited about this, about what was happening there, shouted a lot, and then the Georgians didn't receive any support. And so I think the Ukrainians' calculations, what's actually going to happen? And so I think that's part of the problem. What we're dealing with here is, on the one hand, the Russians have been really quite clear about what they're going to do and what they want. And, you know, annexing Crimea was clearly a pretty bold and ambitious step. So I think they've been very clear, but I think the West, on the other end, has not been very clear. Now, we've seen some statements out of the White House and out of some European countries about how there's red lines for Russia. But, you know, they've declared these red lines before and we haven't really seen anything. Now, I'm not advocating that we go down the path of an actual war and conflict. That's absolutely not. And I think anything should be done to avoid such a situation. But I think that the sense of prevarication one gets from Western powers and the EU in particular, it does not help the situation. And when you've got this very febrile civil war that's clearly brewing, you know, whether these individuals who took over these buildings in Donetsk and Luhan, I'm getting that name wrong, I'm sorry, you know, whether they were sent by Russia, whether they were connected to Russia in some way, is somewhat tangential in some way. The point is that this is a very febrile situation, where on the one hand you have a group pushing, you have a country pushing very hard, on the other hand, it's not clear.
What about that paralysis, Matthew, that Raffaello describes there from the EU in particular and from a number of Western leaders, why is there this strange stasis, this inability, or is it a lack of willingness to say anything or to commit to anything? Why is that happening?
I mean, I completely agree with Raf about what he said about especially the EU in particular, because this really is the moment now. If you recall back in the Bosnia crisis, at the very early stages of that, I believe it was the Belgian foreign minister said at the time, this is the hour of Europe. And what happened? Nothing. And 3 years on, it took NATO to intervene under American leadership, as it really always does, again, under Kosovo. And I think, really, this is a key moment for Europe now to stand up and take responsibility for its security and defence on its own back door, on its own continent. And the United States wants it to do that as well, because America can't shoulder the burden for all of this. But I think the reason is because, first of all, there is political paralysis. It's a union of 28 member states who don't speak with one voice, even though there's the common foreign and defense security policy, but that's another story. The Germans, of course, are very heavily dependent on Russian gas, and also Mr. Obama, there are great concerns, of course, over the American leadership, because what we're seeing now is a pattern developing in President Obama's foreign policy. The red lines over Syria turned pink. He didn't enforce them. He has said things about North Korea, launching missiles and so on, which he hasn't backed up. And then, of course, now we have Ukraine as well. And so if I were an adversary of America, I would see a pattern developing here where the president puts down a red line, doesn't back it up, then tries to sort things out with diplomacy or sanctions, but is very averse to actually, coming down hard on a military option.
Just finally on this point, Raffaello, was this a missed opportunity for Britain, perhaps not constrained in some of the ways that certainly the Germans are, maybe some of our European colleagues, and also with perhaps more of a direct line to something that would actually make a difference, namely the purse strings of a lot of these oligarchs and others? Could Britain, aside from whether they should, could Britain have done a little more, maybe even acting, not unilaterally, but sort of being seen to lead?
Well, I mean, the difficulty is, of course, the UK has had historically a very tense relationship with Russia. We can look back at a number of sort of events. I mean, for me, what really brought it home was when I went to Russia using a British passport and discovered that British passports have to pay a higher visa toll than all other Europeans, which kind of really resonated at home how the UK does have a different relationship with Russia. So I don't actually know if this is the situation where the UK would have been in a position to really play this sort of leadership role. I know Ben Judah, a sort of regular here on Monocle, has been writing very well about this fact, and very caustically, in fact, about the sort of UK's control of Russian purse strings and the fact they're not really doing anything with it. I mean, that's something that they could have done. I think they've done a little bit of it, but I don't think this is a situation where we're going to see the UK would have been the natural fit and the right lead for this. There's other European powers who would have been a better fit for that role.
We'll continue covering the crisis in Ukraine, of course, here on Monocle 24. But now we turn to a historic visit by the American Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, to China. Yesterday, we saw Hagel become the first Western official aboard the country's newest and only aircraft carrier, the Liaoning. Today, the tone was decidedly chillier as the two sides traded some barbs over the Senkaku Islands, or known, of course, by various names. The Americans, Raffaello, have been pushing for closer cooperation in some respects. We saw some high-level meetings talking about the tackling cyber warfare, for example. The first of many, a happy new union, or is that all just wishful thinking, do you think?
Well, I think that a lot of these disputes that we see over the islands, these are kind of pro forma statements that people have to make at these discussions. I mean, the US has to support this Japanese ally, and it genuinely wants to. I don't mean pro forma in the sense of it's just a right that's irrelevant. It is symbolic, but it is is also symbolic. And the Chinese know that the Americans are going to come and say this, you know, and so they know, everyone knows what the kind of game plan is going to be. You make your statements and then we move on and actually talk about business. And I think you see that a lot with the Chinese relationships on some of these issues that they say are very sort of febrile important to them. They choose sometimes to prod a little bit more, but I think most of the time they're kind of carrying it. And when we're looking at the US-China relationship, it's one that I think both sides would say is an important one, and a very important one for both of them going forwards, and it's one that they tried to manage. You know, a lot of the difficulties in the sort of South China Sea and other spaces like that, it's really about managing these smaller powers' expectations and interests rather than the US and China wanting to go clash. And so I think that's a fundamental point here. I mean, I would point to the other thing that which you mentioned at the beginning was, you know, Chuck Hagel getting to be the first to go wander around on the Liaoning. This is the pride of the Japanese Chinese PLNAN. You know, this is their pride and joy.
Is that just PR, or do you think that does represent something slightly? I mean, I'm still strangely slightly surprised to see that. Is that just because I'm underestimating the Chinese PR machine, or do you think it does represent something a bit different?
Well, I think it's you know, on the one hand, there is an there has been a long time emphasis to try to build a mill relationship between China and the US. So in a way, this, what better way to do it than, you know, on the other hand, it also shows that the Chinese can show to the Americans, say, look, we do have one of these aircraft carriers. You may have 14 or whatever it is, but you know, we got one. We got another one on the way sometimes. So, you know, I think there's an element of that sort of PR aspect. But I think it's also a genuine, you know, this is the part of the relationship that has always traditionally been the weakest, the mill one. So I think, you know, developing these contacts, having these sorts of meetings is important.
Matthew, just on this point, how would you sort of assess in broad terms the Chinese willingness then to shift slightly? Do you think that they would entertain slightly closer ties? Is this just political pragmatism? It's what it's expedient at the time? Or do you think that fundamentally they'll be most concerned about, you know, retaining a particular territorial dominance in certain key areas, certain key theatres, and they won't be that interested in what America thinks about it one way or the other, frankly?
It's very difficult to tell with the Chinese because they can be very inscrutable and opaque at the best of times in terms of their diplomacy. But with regards to that question, I'm often reminded actually what the fantastic Chinese Premier Zhu Enlai said on the 200th anniversary of the French Revolution in 1989. And he was asked, what are the long-term implications and the legacy of the French Revolution? And he replied, it's far too soon to tell. And that's exactly what I would think about this. It's really difficult to know what the Chinese really want at the end of the day. But I think really, you know, the relationship between America and China is of fundamental, crucial importance in the 21st century. It is the most important bilateral relationship that is going to affect so much of the balance of power on the planet. Forget about Russia, because as I said previously, Russia is not a superpower. It's a spoiler, and it's just trying to get attention, etc. The big focus should be on China, and of course the pivot to Asia has been so important, which I think actually has Secretary Kerry has, I think, lost focus on that.
Rafael, you...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that, you know, Matthew makes a good point there, which is that, you know, for the China-US relationship is going to be very important globally, but I think for the Chinese, this is the important foreign policy relationship. You know, this is the priority. If you look at, you know, what the seven men ruling China from Zhongnanhai are sitting there thinking, you know, priority number one is, you know, maintenance of the Communist Party's control over the country. Issue number two is domestic stability. When they look foreign policy and it comes lower down on the list, the United States is the only relationship that really matters to them. The other ones are all sort of connected in some way, shape, or form and have their specific intricacies, but it's really the American one that gives them pride of place. And again, this plays back to the CCP because, you know, for the leadership to be able to say that we are on a par with the world's superpower, that helps elevate them in the eyes of the population and the world. And so that shows them to be the great power that they believe themselves to be.
Those are the insights of Raffaello Pantucci here alongside Matthew Jamieson and me. Tom Edwards on Middle House. When we return after a very short break, we'll hear why the head of Hezbollah believes the battle is won in Syria, and we'll head into space, to find out why long-haul travel here on Earth could soon be a thing of the past, at least if Virgin Galactic is to be believed. Stay tuned for that.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 24 minutes past the hour. Still with me is Matthew Jameson and Raffaello Pantucci. We're going to turn now to Syria's civil war, a war the head of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, says can no longer be lost. During an interview with the Al Safia newspaper, Nasrallah said the Assad regime was no longer in danger of being toppled and that the risk of Syria's breakup had come and gone. Here are some comments made earlier in the year. Let's take a listen to this. This was what Nasrallah had to say.
If we have 100 fighters in Syria, they will become 200. If we have 500 fighters in Syria, they will become 1,000. You are mistaken. You are hitting the wrong spot. You are hitting the wrong spot. And if the battle with these Takfiri terrorists requires that I and all of Hezbollah will head to Syria, then we will all go to Syria.
That was Hassan Nasrallah earlier in the year. Let's get some analysis now from both Matthew and Raffaello. Matthew, intriguing, isn't it? You listen to these, the sort of rhetoric you hear. Do you think this is a delicate balance for Hezbollah to strike? You perhaps wouldn't know it listening to that, but their involvement in Syria perhaps risks retaliation from other elements, you know, back home in Lebanon. Do you think it's a highly risky strategy?
Very much so. It's a high wire act, and I don't actually think that Hezbollah want to be in this position themselves. And remember, of course, Hezbollah are a creation of Iran. Iran is their primary patron and sponsor, and they do basically what Iran tells them. And Iran sent the order around about the spring of last year for Hezbollah to intervene because the rebels were gaining so much ground. And the Assad regime, the last thing that Tehran was going to do was lose their ally there. So they ordered Hezbollah to intervene because, of course, this is very difficult. These are Muslims killing fellow Muslims. And as I have said before, actually, if you look at the whole sort of history post 9/11, most Muslims in the Middle East or even in Southeast Asia or wherever have been subjected to violence or killed by fellow Muslims. And this goes to the heart of the huge sectarian conflict going on in the Middle East between Shia and Sunni. So Hamas, of course, have broke off contact with the Damascus regime. I think really this is going to, this could have serious blowback for Hezbollah in the long term.
What's the objective then, do you think, Raffaello? Is this about establishing a power base in Syria? Is it part of that broader sectarian divide? I mean, why is there this? Why are they stretching themselves in this direction if it is so risky?
Well, I think a lot of it is what Matthew's pointing out, the connection with Iran. I think the Iranian regime clearly said to them, you've got to go to the war, go to the mattresses, to quote the Godfather. And they really did. And what's interesting is Hezbollah really threw all their chips in. And, there was a point at which people began to wonder, could Syria be the breaking point of Hezbollah? Because, this is fundamentally meant to be an organization that is a movement that's protecting a certain group of people within Lebanon. And then suddenly they're going on these sorts of offensive missions. It kind of loses its coherence as an entity. And if you look back at some of the statements that Nasrallah has made, he's directly contradicted himself quite a few times. And that's quite a serious deal.
Would you characterize this as a strategic error then by the
No, I don't think it's a strategic error because it looks like it's worked out. The thing I would say is that it worked out because there's two points to this story which I think is significant. On the one hand, Hezbollah did throw all its chips in. I mean, it was all in for this one. Now, it needed to make sure the Assad regime won, and they pushed, and initially they were doing only a little bit of support, then they really put the boot in, sent in a lot of people, recruited more people from abroad, really set themselves up to be one of the key conduits to support the Assad regime. And on the other hand, what we've seen in the past few months is, frankly, the Assad regime is kind of winning, and there is the infighting on the rebel side has had a very negative impact. The fact that you've got sort of ISIS fighting against Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham and all the Islamic front that emerges, and then there's still the FSA battalions out there, the Kurds in the north. There's all this squabbling on the rebel side, which means that you no longer have a coherent force that's actually fighting against the regime. And so actually, if we had this discussion about a year ago, I would argue that, I remember talking to people at the time, the sense was we're going to see a Balkanization of the country, and you'll end up having a sort of, a Druze heartland at the bottom, a little Kurd bit at the top, and something that controlled by the Alawites on the coast, and the rest will be this big sort of Sunni mess ruled by different factions and whatnot. I think that picture's very much changed. I think you still probably do have an element of a sort of some sort of Kurdish homeland, heartland up at the top. But I would argue that, in fact, the regime controls an increasing portion of the country. And you've still got these sort of pockets that are controlled by different Islamist groups or rebel factions. But overwhelmingly, we're seeing that they're, you know, the Assad regime is actually becoming quite efficient in terms of taking back territory and holding it, in terms of deploying the Hezbollah forces in supportive roles in important ways. I mean, the point about the Hezbollah forces was that they were very dedicated. And you saw there was like a noticeable change in some of the conflicts where previously, you know, the regime forces who were doing it for sort of money and protecting the homeland to some degree would kind of flee the battlefield, you know, or move back. The Hezbollah guys would not give up. They would fight to the death. They would use suicide attacks. They would do all these sorts of tactics, which does have an impact on the battlefield. And so I think the real lesson here is, on the one hand, Hezbollah really did throw all chips in, and it looks like it's paying off because the Assad regime does seem like it's going to stay in power and control more of the country than maybe people expected.
Indeed, and it's perhaps, as you point out, less fragmented than we may have anticipated. Yeah. Our time is almost up on today's programme. Before we go, though, I think it is right for us to take our trip to space, shall we? That's the dramatic footage from the third test flight of Virgin Galactic earlier this year. The CEO of the project, George Whitesides, is already looking beyond space tourism, though. He said he envisions a network of point-to-point high-speed flights via spaceports as a means to reduce long-haul travel. Still several years away from reality, but Virgin have already commenced construction on a spaceport, which is a real thing, I'm delighted to say, in Abu Dhabi, which will be opened by 2016. In brief, gentlemen, is this the future? We'll be all boarding our spacecraft to travel long haul in the next couple of years?
I'm looking forward to it.
I certainly hope so. I'm a massive Star Trek fan, so to boldly go.
Absolutely. But what do you think, in all seriousness, is it going to be up to private enterprise to sort of go to these places where no one has gone before? Or do you think that there is a role for nation states? Is it troubling that it seems to be private enterprise the driver?
We did have it before with Concorde. I mean, Concorde used to be this sort of a thing. There was that great thing if you could travel back in time, essentially traveling from Europe to the US. So we kind of seen it before. That didn't work because it didn't become cost effective after a bad crash. I suspect that this is probably in the same direction. As this technology becomes cheaper, I don't see why it wouldn't become more accessible. I'm really looking forward to it. So, you know, I can't wait to take a plane, a spaceship from New Mexico to Abu Dhabi, though I'll be honest, there's a two places I probably don't have much reason to visit, but you know.
Well, you'll both be delighted then if we just sign you up and send you on the spacecraft when the time is right. Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you both very much for joining me. That's Matthew Jameson and Raffaella Pantucci here on today's Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be heading to Rio to check in with our Sheena Rossiter there to see what's making news in Brazil. And we'll be heading to Salone del Mobile when we'll also review the week in music. Before all of that excitement, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who has the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukrainian police have cleared pro-Moscow protesters from a regional administration building in Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine, but Donetsk and Luhansk held out today. Kiev says this is concerned that there could be Moscow-backed moves to break away, like in Crimea. The former US National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden has given testimony on Tuesday to a parliamentary hearing on mass surveillance at the Council of Europe in Strasbourg. The US intelligence operative, who spoke from Moscow via live video link for more than half an hour, said that the NSA had deliberately snooped on public bodies. The leader of Turkey's main opposition party, Cemal Kılıçdaroğlu, has been attacked at the Turkish parliament today as he was heading to his party's weekly group meeting to deliver his speech. The incident was caught by camera crews at the parliament buildings in Ankara. The assailant punched him in the face as the Republican People's Party leader was walking in the hallway outside the main chamber. And the UN has responded to important developments in Afghanistan and Somalia, lauding the success of last weekend's Afghanistan presidential and provincial elections. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Jonathan Wheatley will be back, of course, with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. Right now, though, on Midori House, it's time for us to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world today. I'm delighted to say we're heading to the sandy beaches of Copacabana. Joining us from Rio is Monocle's woman there, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, very good day to you. Thanks for joining us, as always. But tell me, it's not all good news for Rio. I gather Sao Paulo has pipped them to a particular post. Tell us more.
Hi there, Tom. Yes, exactly. Between these two rival cities, Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo always has seemed to kind of be left in the dust, so to speak, because it's kind of more commonly overlooked by travelers and people in general as just an overcrowded, polluted city with bad traffic and no beach. But there's good news for that city today because TripAdvisor's Traveler's Choice Destinations has recently ranked Sao Paulo number 3 in the top destinations here in South America, one spot ahead of Rio de Janeiro. So in a way, this is a big rivalry for the two. This is a big victory for the two rival cities, especially since Sao Paulo is commonly overlooked. Of course, there was no Brazilian city in the top 10 of the international cities, with the top 3 cities being Istanbul, Rome, and then London. Of the South American cities, of the top 25 cities, there were 12 Brazilian cities in the top 25 of the South American cities. But of course, in terms of international tourism, Brazil still has a little ways to go.
And I guess one of the things that helps with sort of this kind of reputation, this kind of tourist data, Sheena, is, you know, being ready to welcome the travellers. How do we know that Brazil is faring in terms of being ready for the World Cup? Because there's been a lot of talk about whether a lot of infrastructure projects will be up to standard. Some concerns that some further airports may not be ready until the World Cup's done and dusted and left town.
Yes, exactly. Brazil has been struggling with delays on many fronts for the World Cup, from stadiums to roads to just basic telecommunications infrastructure as well. The latest one to come under attack is the airports. So O Globo, one of the biggest newspapers here in Brazil, has reported that at least 6 of the airports in 12 of the host cities will be not ready for the World Cup that is happening on June 12th. Basically, the president of Infraero, which is a state-run company that controls these airports, basically has said, well, we're just going to kind of have to fool or make it, or sidestep in a sense, to get these airports ready. The airports in 6 of the 12 host cities, which are Belo Horizonte, Curitiba, Salvador, Porto Alegre, Cuiabá, and Fortaleza, are the ones that are running behind. They're already running with deadlines that are going to have those airports ready after the World Cup is over. Now, with the World Cup happening in just 10 weeks, that's just not good news. So, for example, in Fortaleza, there's going to be a canvas structure that will be greeting tourists in that city, as opposed to the new terminal that was planned. That city, Fortaleza, will be hosting 6 matches in total, one of which is going to be a quarterfinal. So there are major concerns over this because there's expected to be 3 million Brazilians traveling within the country during the World Cup. And then on top of that, Brazil will be greeting 600,000 international tourists for the event, which is the biggest influx of tourists that Brazil has ever had.
And Sheena, tell me, who's going to, if this stuff isn't ready and there are problems, who's going to pay the penalty? Is this going to reflect badly on Dilma? Will there be other sort of authority figures or sort of aspects of who've been in charge of logistics? Who's got the most to lose if it doesn't deliver what was promised?
Definitely President Dilma Rousseff. This has been part of her $100 billion draw, where she was trying to inject private investment into public infrastructure projects in order to get some of these projects done on time and just to simply upgrade the infrastructure throughout the country. If this doesn't go as planned, she definitely has a lot to lose, because in October there will be federal elections. Although Dilma is looking good and it's likely that she will be re-elected come October, this still does not reflect well on her infrastructure plans, where she has tried to have PPP, private-public partnerships, to upgrade the country's infrastructure.
What about jobs, though, Sheena? Because we often expect to see a huge degree of job generation during these sorts of big projects, because there's all of the service industries, there's lots of infrastructure, as we know. Are there any estimations about how many jobs might be created? And is that perhaps a bit of a good news headline for Dilma and others?
Definitely, that is a great news headline. Actually, as today, it was announced by CNC, which is Brazil's National Confederation of Services and Tourism. They announced that the World Cup will generate around 50,000 jobs, 47,900 jobs to be exact. And that is going to be in areas such as hospitality, food, transportation, tourism services, and cultural and recreation activities. So within those areas, that corresponds to a 38.1% increase from the 125,000 jobs that were created last year. If we want to get into specifics, in the food and beverage industry alone, 16,100 jobs are going to be created, about 14,000 jobs in the transport industry, and 12,300 jobs in the hotel and services industry. Of the sectors, this is expected to make up 88.4% of the new jobs that will be created just for the World Cup. So obviously a large chunk is going towards those industries, which the expected less than 20% would be obviously jobs that were created in infrastructure such as stadium construction and also the airports, which we just spoke about. But of course, this is good news for Brazil. And these jobs are all temporary, though. That is an important thing to mention, that these are jobs that are going to be created between April of this year and June. So what will happen after the World Cup is hard to say, but it's still good news for Brazil. 50,000 jobs will be created by this 32-day tournament.
We'll keep a close eye on those figures, though, won't we, Sheena, and make sure that the jobs that are promised do actually arrive, of course. From Rio, that's Monocle's correspondent there, Sheena Roster. Up next on Midori House, we'll be heading to Milan to see what trends are making headlines at this year's Salone. Stay tuned to find out more right here on Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Insta paper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, 1842 here in London, at Salone del Mobile. It's the world's most important design fair held each year in the city of Milan, of course. Everything is featured, from the newest trends for your coffee table to the fabrics making waves this year in upholstery. Throughout the fair, Monocle 24 will be there from all the angles. Joining me now for a quick preview of this year's event, it's Monocle's Alad John. Alad, I gather you got there in the end, in a roundabout kind of way. Once you arrived, finally, what kind of things were catching your eye?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Despite Alitalia's best efforts to scupper our trip to Milan, we managed to get here just in time for all the interviews that I'd lined up for Monocle 24 and for Section D, the design show that I produced. It's a funny thing, Milan, because at this time of year, you really have to observe the theatricality of the things going on. Everyone is very much a sense of people wanting to be seen as well as seen. There are literally thousands and thousands of exhibitors that are dotted around the city, but also at the fair itself. The fair itself is actually, I have to be honest, something that I try to avoid, because despite the literally thousands of exhibitors and the 300,000 visitors that go there, it's quite difficult, as you might imagine, to sift through all that stuff and get to the really good stuff, which is there. It's just quite difficult to find. So So I tend to stay in the town, the Brera district, the New Culture district, which is the 5Z. Rosano Alandi is lovely. Design Junction is a British collection. They do a great event space. And I also pass by a collaboration between two quite well-known brands, Kosh, the clothing maker, and Nendo, the design studio, founded by Oki Sato. And I spoke to Kosh's head of menswear and head of womenswear, Karen Gustafsson and Martin Anderson, as well as Oki Sato, to hear what their collaboration was all about.
The white shirt is a core garment here at COS. It's about redesigning the wardrobe staples, reinventing them every season. We think that the white shirt is a multifunctional garment. You can wear it at any occasion. It's like a white canvas. You can redesign it in so many different ways. And then when we came up to do this collaboration with Nendo, when we do these collaborations, we tend to give the sort of designer carte blanche, as it were, so we have quite free rein to interpret the brand. And he came to us with a suggestion of the white shirt, which we then were thrilled about, super excited that he kind of saw that kind of connection with us.
Looking at that collaboration, the white shirt is obviously very iconic, if you will, for COS. It's a very important and pure idea to an extent. What is it about Nendo's work and Oki Sato's work more generally that attracted you to collaborating with him, Karen?
We really, really like his work. We think he's always working with understated design, but really especially like his use of materials and surfaces. So, for example, downstairs, you know, we saw these glass tables that are in material glass, but they replicate the feeling of wood. And that feels really, really interesting.
So how do you kind of include that level of interest, that fun, the playfulness of that design into your clothing?
Well, I mean, it's sort of about reimagining, you know, everyday garments for us, for Nendo's everyday items. And as Karin mentioned, you know, our design aesthetics tend to be focused around function and quite simple design. So it's so much about the materials.
Yeah, and also we like that sort of contrast. We love when a material looks in one way but feels in another way. And we're very much into fabrics and hand feels of fabrics. So the whole sort of tactility of materials are very important when we pick the materials for the garments.
It's probably a good time to bring in Oki Sato.
How are you
good
doing?
To see you.
Good to see you again.
Oki, we were just discussing the kind of how excited they were for you to come on board and collaborate with COS. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you being approached?
It was amazing because we had so much in common. Like the COS brand and Nendo, the way we think about design, the way we approach design was so similar. The simplicity and the purity and the functionality, and also the way they really focus on the small details. So I didn't feel like it was like two different teams working on a single project, but it felt like a single team. The only thing that was very new for me was the mood board. That was my first time to see a mood board, and it was so interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's talk about the white shirt. We've discussed it momentarily, but why was that an important thing for you to kind of hook the collaboration around?
When I was looking through the archives of the COS brand and the catalog, I noticed that by looking at the white shirts, you really understand the COS philosophy in a way. I think that was the most talkative piece in a way, so I wanted to have the white shirts talking in the space. That was the basic idea that I had behind this installation.
Collaborations can be tricky, I guess, to an extent. Was it plain sailing? You mentioned that, Martin, that you normally give collaborators carte blanche, a blank canvas to work from, but here, Oki obviously had his own ideas as well. Was it completely harmonious or complicated and challenging at the same time?
I think it was completely harmonious, actually. Honestly, it was. The first time, you know, you came to the office and presented this idea, and you had such a beautiful scale done up of
it.
And we were all kind of, yes, this is great. You know, this is really great. So.
Yeah, it really sort of left us with a spring in the step after we just like jumped out of the room.
Yeah.
Like, but it's fantastic.
Okay, what does Salone mean for you guys? And of course, you've collaborated in Milan before. You're present in Milan. It's very important in your career as well. Is Salone an important time? Is it the key thing of the year to showcase new material of your own?
Yes, definitely. Milan is the place where we show things. I can't think of any other places. Well, maybe 10 years ago, it was a place for selling furniture and buying furniture, but not anymore. It's a place for to share new ideas and new ways of living, and I think it's a place for everyone who wants to share ideas, basically. So I think this installation between Nendo and Kos, it fits in perfectly in Milan.
Do you find Salone a bit, it can be quite complacent to an extent? There's so much going on there, perhaps. The challenging stuff gets lost in the mix a little bit. Do you find that?
Well, it is expanding. It's getting bigger and bigger, and it's almost impossible to look at all of the exhibitions in 5 days, was it? 6 days? Yeah, it's... But I think it's still the place to be, definitely. It's huge, and there's things that are good and things that are not good as well, but that's Milan, I guess, yeah.
What I like about it is that, I mean, this is our third year that we're here now, and it's that you find your little areas which you can really click into. I mean, for 2 years we've been in Lambrate, which we love to go around and explore, and we don't tend to go out to the main fair to look around so much, and that's not very relevant to us, but, you know, so you find your little pockets and you tend to stay there, I think.
That was Monocle's Allard John with a couple of the people he's met at Salone already today. We'll be hearing from him and the rest of our team, of course, all through this week here on Monocle 24. Yes, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's time now, before the end of the show, to get a check on the week in music. I'm delighted to say we're joined here in the studio by Pete Norton, who writes about music, podcasts and radio for the Telegraph newspaper here in London. Pete, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you with us, of course. Now, this is always rather exciting. Where are we going to go? It's a musical adventure that we're on. Where should we start? What about Rodrigo Amarante? Tell me a little bit about this one first.
Yes, I think his name is pronounced Rodrigo Amarante. If my Portuguese pronunciation is terrible. I began by calling him Amarante, but then someone put me up on it.
And now you're doing it to me live. Thank you so much.
So nice to pass that on. I feel a little bit less.
No, I should have got that right, given some of my colleagues are probably fans of his, actually, here at Midori House. Anyway, what's Rodrigo Amarante got for us?
So he is quite a well-known figure in Brazil already. He's a member of a group called Los Hermanos, and he was part of a samba supergroup, Orquestra Imperial, and has collaborated with various different people, sort of icons of the Brazilian folk scene. He's also been a member of a popular US sort of supergroup called Little Joy, alongside a guy from The Strokes and someone called Binky Shapiro. But this is his first solo album, and it's out, I think, next month. It's out on the 5th of May, and it's sort of a really interesting blend. It mixes kind of shimmering disco kind of upbeat stuff with more melancholic, reflective kind of songs. I think it's a really, really interesting thing. He sings in Portuguese, French, and English.
He sounds multi-talented.
So he is, yeah. He's a bit of a sort of jack of all trades, or you know,
a polymath. I hate people like that.
I know. They're the most annoying.
But so it does sound like a pretty intriguing combination. Should we take a little listen and see what our listeners make of it?
For sure.
Let's hear. This one is Manya. That one.
I think it's got a bit of a shimmer to it.
It has a shimmer. It has a kind of summery quality. I'm feeling that's about right. It's coming out in May, you know, certainly here in the slightly drab UK.
Yeah, and he's touring Europe in May as well. So if you have a sort of an itch that needs to be scratched by that, then
I have a summery itch that needs a good scratching. Well, yeah. Rodrigo Amarante can be the man to scratch it for me.
Well, I hope so.
Musically, of course, you understand. where should we turn next, Pete? Let's talk about, I'll let you pronounce this one. Todd. Okay, tell me about Todd. Yeah, what's he been up to?
I've actually mugged up on how to pronounce his name today. I've chosen really difficult people to pronounce. Todd Tareya, I think his name is. He's a Norwegian DJ, songwriter and record producer. Mm. And he's been around for a while. He's been a sort of a real staple of the Scandinavian kind of dance DJ scene. He's also done, he co-wrote a Robbie Williams hit a couple of years ago, which I think a lot of record producers do now as a way of kind of funding their other pursuits. Mm. They do these big collaboration hits. So he's kind of hip and pop in his own kind of way. Up to this point, he's released EPs and edits of other songs and remixes. He's done he did a fantastic remix of Paul Simon's song, Michael Jackson songs, which are kind of just out there online. But this is his first album, which is been released this week. It's called It's Album Time. It's rather a playful record, and it's just full of fun for me. I think it's fantastic dance music. It's not too obtuse. It's not too kind of show-offy or experimental. Mm. It's music that makes you want to dance.
And it's interesting, isn't it, when you have these producers who, again, sort of turn their hand to everything. It's a bit different, isn't it, when you put your own material out there on the line. Some people can fall foul of it. In short, do you think he's done a pretty decent job? He's made a good fist of his getting his first solo.
Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic record. Really unpretentious and great fun, and I'm sure it'll do very well.
Well, if it gets people dancing, maybe we should play a little and see if our listeners feel so inspired. I think the track we're going to hear is called DeLorean Dynamite. Let's take a listen. That took me straight to the sort of mid-80s.
Yeah, there is a touch of that to it. There's a touch of... we missed the beginning of that track. It begins in quite a sort of Giorgio Moroder, Donna Summer kind of way.
Yeah, that's what I was
but
feeling.
It's got a lot of... There's a lot to it, yeah. There's definitely
a Giorgio Moroder vibe.
Thrusting.
Exactly, being thrown in these shapes, being thrown in our control room by my producer, Phil. Yeah. I can only apologise for those dance moves. He's pretty nimble.
Sure, very good.
He's nimble for an older fellow.
Well, and he's only sitting down.
Before the top of the hour, let's talk about... where should we go next? Well, let's talk about Salad Day. The album from Mac DeMarco. We're going to play a track, Let Her Go, in a minute, but just tell us a little bit about Mac DeMarco.
So he's kind of precocious young 23-year-old from Canada. He's been around for a while. I sort of noticed him a couple of years ago. He released his album called Two, which is fantastic. And basically he's a really good songwriter, and he's got this amazing guitar sound, which is very much his own, which is a kind of thing you can't buy. Mm. He really sounds, you can tell it's him when you hear a record. And he plays, apparently, a guitar that cost him $30 Canadian, but he bought it when he was 16, he's still got it. It's this kind of beaten up thing. I don't know, I find that kind of cool.
No, you've got to love a story like that.
Yeah, I know, that kind of works. But it's also, this is his latest album released this week, which is just great. Interestingly, the song that we're going to play, I think he is not happy with, apparently. His record label asked him to make a more sort of poppy upbeat song that would get radio play, which is how it's achieved today. Here we are. And I think it really works. It is a very good advertisement for his style, and I don't quite understand why he's not into it. But
he must be one of these difficult perfectionists that we spend so much time reading
about. I think
he is.
He's an artist. Yeah.
Let's take a listen and see whether Mac DeMarco does indeed have anything to worry about, or whether he should just relax and read your verdict and stop worrying so much. This is called Let Her Go. Let's take a listen. That's Let Her Go, Mac DeMarco. He's a multi-instrumentalist as well and a multimedia artist. You've brought me a selection of polymaths today.
I couldn't help myself.
Insufferably capable people. but what do you make of that? It's interesting. I know it's quite tempting to try and, you know, pigeonhole musical genres, isn't it? I mean, I don't even quite know how you'd sort of describe that one.
I've actually got some crib notes here. There's a few very funny ways people describe it. He's been described as blue wave, slacker rock and off-kilter pop, which could equally have come from some sort of Chris Morris Brass Eye kind of collection there. But I'm not sure how... I mean, people... Indie rock, but he's kind of quite on the more original end of the
a little
off-kilter.
I think that's a good place to go at times,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Pete, I like to have fun on this segment and get people to sort of select a track of the week or one that they have to encourage our listeners to go and choose from their
you know, admittedly pretty good trio. Where would you go out of those three? Do you have a favourite?
I think probably the Amaranch song.
Rodrigo Amaranch.
I think I've had that one. I've been listening to that one for a while. The other two, I've got these albums this week and have been listening to it. But the Amaranch one, I've had for a while, and it's still got it for me. It's still fresh. So
great
on
stuff.
That basis, I'll say.
Summary sounds of Rodrigo Amaranch. Lovely stuff. Pete Norton from The Telegraph. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to my guests, Matthew Jameson and Raffaello Pantucci, of course. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sierra Fournier, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Tune in then. Until then, bye-bye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.